The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Always an honor and privilege to be in for Dory Monson, a good friend and my favorite regional local radio host, and just an incredible guy. We're looking forward to hearing him again, but I am in for Dory today and tomorrow, and have been scheduled on that schedule for some time. So that brings us to try to do the best Dory show that we can, which means not as good as Dory himself, but we'll try our best. David Bowes in for Dory Monson. Let's get to the big lead.
The big lead, big local.
Well, of course, top big lead, and this is just I knew if there was a local, if there was a local media television presence that would get to this issue, it would be Brandi Crews. And it was, it's the comments that Jay Inslee made back in the day about CHOP. Remember the CHOP zone comments where Governor Inslee said that he had no idea that CHOP was even going on. He just kind of threw up his hands like, wait a second, there's this autonomous zone in Seattle. First I'm hearing about it. I'm not responsible for it. It has nothing to do with me. It's funny, people used to talk about Reagan as the Teflon president, but Inslee's really the Teflon governor if there ever was one. Because when a major scandal erupts or something significant happens in his administration and it might cast him negatively, it's either covered as some kind of thing that he's responding to. You know, let's say it's a Department of Corrections early release of prisoners, then it's something that, you know, he's responding to it to fix it. So he gets to be the fixer instead of the guy on whose watch the thing collapsed on. And there's something similar with the Seattle CHOP zone where people are wondering, wait a second, is there law and order in the city, in the state of Washington, in the major city, in the heart of this, of the Pacific Northwest here, Seattle? Do you get to choose which zones are lawful or not? So here's Inslee with Brandi on, this is that moment when he's saying during the CHOP zone controversy, when Inslee was defining his knowledge of what was happening in Seattle.
I'd like to ask you about what's going on in Seattle. There's this thing called the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. What's your thought on that? The fact that the protesters have taken that over and not allowing people to come and go freely? Regarding the guard.
Well, that's news to me, so I'll have to reserve any comment about it. I have not heard anything about that from any credible source.
There is no possibility that that was true at the time. And yet he was pretty much able to just roll with it, right? So we're supposed to believe that the governor had no idea that a major zone within the city of Seattle that was covered, that was taken over by protesters, covered by every major news source, you know, every single major news source nationally and internationally were covering the CHOP zone. And Governor Inslee is saying, you know, I didn't get briefed on that one. So, you know, that does not pass the Bolshevik test as far as the smell test of what is true versus what is not. So then we flash forward to the debate, and Inslee's again asked about the CHOP zone.
What should voters make of the fact that you were apparently oblivious to police abandoning an entire precinct in the state's largest city? You have 1 minute, 15 seconds.
Yeah, well, listen, if you look at the facts of that situation, I could not have been oblivious to it because I actually deployed the Washington State National Guard.
Sir, then why do you say you did not know about it?
You'll have to go back and look at some quote. I can't comment on the quote right now, but I can tell you that what we did was is to respond when cities, and the cities, of course, are the ones responsible for their initial security, and we support the cities.
So, you know, he says, I can't go back to comment on some comment. It's your comment. You know, that's you talking about the economic engine of the state. That's Seattle. I mean, I know that sounds weird to admit, but, you know, Seattle is central to the rest of the state. Seattle likes to think of itself as separate from the rest of the state. It's a bunch of, you know, Eastern Washington. But the fact is we all depend on each other, even if we don't necessarily like each other. And so, you know, here's the governor making this flat-out claim to the press that he knew nothing about it. Then he claims, well, of course I knew. Obviously I knew. Why are you even asking this question? I can't comment on some comment that was made before. Well, this is one of those few times where where Governor Inslee is being held to account for his comments and his leadership here, and he's basically trying to shrug it off. So here's Brandi Cruz describing, you know, her view on how she, well, I mean, basically she nailed him here, but this is her view now.
You're asked about CHOP. You said it's news to you. In the debate, you said, I knew about CHOP. I sent in the National Guard. Of course, the National Guard isn't relevant to the CHOP situation. So what is the reality of your knowledge of that situation 2 days after it happened when you were asked about it?
Well, obviously, I knew about a disturbance on Capitol Hill. The whole state knew about that disturbance, so actually I knew about it. And the situation is I had not received as much current information up to date that I would like to have had before I made some big pronouncement. And when I make a pronouncement about something, you'd like to have the most current information. I did not have that. What I should have said was, I'm gonna hold my pronouncements till I get the most current lowdown on what's going on. So I misspoke. I misspeak at least once every 8 years, and Trudy will tell you that. So,
all right. So he shrugs it off with the charm of a good politician, or a practiced politician, at the very least. You know, but the reality is he just lied about it. He lied about it at the time because it was an embarrassing issue. He didn't want to have to tackle it. He has other ambitions and doesn't want to have to take on the radical left of Seattle because they're compromising they make up a significant portion of his base. I'm not saying he's not afraid of – I don't think he's afraid for his own reelection as governor. But I think he has ambitions to go beyond Washington State. So that's what he's looking at, and he doesn't want to have any problems in that area. So, you know, he's got a lot of confidence for what he can do or what he can say here. He's able to shrug it off. He flat out lies about it, and then he comes back and says, well, you know, I should have said something differently. I just wasn't quite briefed enough. That alone, by the way, brings up another interesting follow-up question, which is, as governor of the state of Washington, with riots and destruction happening in the midst of a pandemic and in the midst of a severe pandemic-related economic retraction, the kind of damage that can severely set back your state, when the heart of the city of Seattle is taken over by protesters, you're saying you don't get up-to-date briefings on that? Why? Where is the security staff? Where is the what is their function, if not to advise them on situations like that? Yeah, I mean, just put it in a natural disaster kind of approach. Let's say there was an earthquake and you've got, you know, the middle of Seattle, you're out of touch with it. Wouldn't you expect to have boots on the ground and people updating the governor right away to figure out what's needed? Of course, you know, I cannot imagine. I hate to give Dow Constantine. I can't imagine Dow Constantine saying, you know what, I just didn't get briefed on that. Because who would buy that? And Inslee's able to get away with it because he's got this kind of aw shucks, you know, attitude of, well, you know, I sure was looking forward to that briefing, but it just didn't happen on time. You know, so Cruz did an excellent job of being one of the few people that actually looked back at what Inslee was saying and then asked him about it and held him to account. But I'd like to see the follow-up of what changes have been made about your briefing process if you're not being briefed on situations like that. How do they make their decisions on what you should be briefed on in an up-to-the-date manner if they're not going to brief you up to the date on a major significant takeover of your city and an absence of law enforcement in the midst of the middle of the city, given the other circumstances that are involved? I just think that's insane, and I don't think that that answer is accurate either. I think that's another duck and cover answer. I would love to see the records of the kinds of briefings that he was getting, you know, and when the last briefing was on the CHOP zone, because no believable way that the governor wasn't being briefed in an up-to-date fashion on that score, unless somebody specifically said, do not brief me in an up-to-date manner on that because I don't want to have to deal with it. Let's dump it on the mayor of Seattle. It's her problem anyway. If she contacts me directly, stall. That's all that makes sense there. I'm just not buying it. Brings us to the next big lead.
The big lead, big local.
Speaking of the mayor of Seattle, you know, here we have Seattle's public places have been shameful for quite a while, but they seem to be improving a little bit. I even had visitors to Seattle telling me, hey, look, you know what? The last time we were here, it just looked like a garbage heap going in and out of Seattle. And then things started to look a lot better. Is it getting better? And I said, I think it's a temporary thing. It looks to be growing again. Because I'm seeing more and more tarp and tent encampments in various public places, and the city seems to be dropping the ball. And sure enough, in public parks, in fact, not just public parks, in the main public park, in Denny Park in Seattle, home of the Parks Department, things have basically collapsed. The navigation team has been defunded. That's the team that goes in and provides social services and other things to these encampments. They're not removing these camps in the same way. They've got public defecation, and so human waste is, shall we say, readily readily apparent in Denny Park. The sanitation is abysmal. There's needles being found. So that while the park has reopened for children to play there, it makes no sense to take your kids there. If you're concerned about COVID, you know, your odds of stepping on a needle in this park seem to be much greater than contracting COVID, based on the number of needles. We're going to talk with the Friends of Denny Park founder coming up later on in the program, and you'll hear about what's happening in Denny Park and just how bad it's gotten. Wait till you hear how many needles that this guy's picking up. I mean, it's just insane what's happening there. And this is basically the mayor of Seattle telling the parks, you're on your own. It's not even that. They're telling the people, the citizens, you're on your own. You pay for a public park, you pay property taxes, expensive property taxes, you pay expensive sales taxes, but this primary basic function of government, we're not capable of following through on that. We can't maintain the parks, we can't maintain public safety, we can't take on these encampments because, well, frankly, there's too much politics behind it. You know, there seems to be a vested interest in tearing things down and refashioning the state, so to speak. And that's going to create big problems for you, big problems for those of you who live in the city, and big problems for the park. If anybody was in town and had a yard in the same condition as some of these public parks, you'd be getting fined on a daily basis, and rightfully so. But the city is not prepared to clean up their own mess. And speaking of messes, it brings us to the next big lead.
The big lead, big local.
This one's worse than the parks. In King County, King 5 has broken a story. Jason Rance has got a good write-up on it at MyNorthwest.com as well. But King 5 has broken the story that King County is not monitoring criminals with ankle monitors. So they got a monitor, but nobody's monitoring it. Now, it doesn't mean they're not ever monitoring it, but between the hours of 3:30 p.m. and 7 a.m., it's not being monitored. Also, weekends are off, too. So the next time you hear about releasing prisoners early and thinking, well, they're going to be electronically monitored, it sounds like a serious thing. My gosh, there's somebody at a computer desk, they're watching, and if anybody goes beyond where they're supposed to in their home, why, an alert's going to go off, and these people are going to be picked up, and there's going to be some consequences. Not so. Apparently, it takes quite a while for things to happen, and in fact, one individual went off away from his confined space wearing his ankle monitor, was able to go out and allegedly assault his then-pregnant girlfriend, revisit her home, assault her six-year-old son, and then maybe setting the apartment on fire and assaulting police at the scene. So, I mean, this is an incredible story breaking from King 5. And Susanna Frame does a bang-up job. She points out that the judges and victim advocates, judges were shocked that this was happening. Judge Jim Rogers, presiding judge for King County Superior Court, told Susanna Frame, "We were deeply shocked and learned about it last week, frankly. It used to be 24/7 monitoring for years, and they never told us they changed it. You know, that's a problem." Okay, but here's another problem. What they actually say in King County is they never monitored 24/7. So the judges for the King County courts thought that they were monitoring 24/7. Turns out they now say they never monitored 24/7. They're not even sure exactly what that would look like. You know, what would we need to do to monitor 24/7. Looks like, you know, they're launching a study, but that sounds laughable to me, too. There's got to be places around the country that are already monitoring. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out if you're monitoring for a certain number of hours a day and you want to monitor for 24 hours a day, you just take a look at how to do that. You hire people to monitor. And it should be, you know, when you're monitoring people with violent habits, the public and victims want to know that if they leave that area, that the police are going to be informed and they're going to be informed. Kind of like an Amber Alert or a Silver Alert, that people in immediate danger would get a text, hey, this person is in trouble. I mean, for crying out loud, the technology's got to be there by now, right? I mean, slap a tile on these guys so that we could see if see when they're lost. This is just crazy to me. You know, I can just imagine the fear that people are in. And then hearing about, with COVID-related reductions in jail and prison populations, all the rage, with politicians and others saying, hey, look, we got to take a look at these electronic monitoring situations because, you know, we don't have the room. We don't want a big COVID outbreak in the jails. I look at this and think, until you get this electronic monitoring fixed, they're going to have to run their risks in jail. You know, and I'm not the kind of person who really, I don't particularly like our current jailing system. It seems rather crazy to me that people do things like steal, and then we throw them in jail and pay $35,000 a year to let them sit there or more. And so they're sucking up a bunch of resources instead of, say, you know, being at their home, being monitored, and then going to work. They should be going to work and paying a heavy tax to repay the people that they stole from and the state for the costs that incurred for us trying to figure out who they were and how they did it. So, you know, I'd much rather have some kind of restitutional thing, get them working for 16 hours a day, put them on the electronic monitoring. But if the electronic monitoring isn't actually functioning and there's nobody there to actually look at them, and they've got the weekends off and they've got evenings off and they've got late nights off. I mean, think about it. When do you think, I mean, I realize it's kind of a misnomer that burglaries always happen at night. It's very frequent during the day because people are out, they're working, but still a lot of criminal activity at night, you know, and here we are. When are we monitoring these guys? Well, you know, it's convenient between breakfast and 3:30 PM. But other than that, they're on their own. You know, I mean, I shudder to think what King 5 will find out about that next, because there's got to be additional material out there. But congratulations to Susanna Frame. I find that news to be chilling. And this should be a huge scandal as well for the executive department. But will it be, or will it be another one of those cases where the politicians, supposedly where the buck stops, are going to be saying, well, you know, I'm reacting to this. I get to be the fixer. I think I can guess where it's going to go. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. There was a Back the Blue, I was about to say protest, but that's really more of a rally. In order to back the police, to say, hey, we appreciate the police. We appreciate the difficulty of their jobs, the difficulty of making split-second, life-changing, life-altering, potentially life-ending decisions. We understand what a difficult job they are, and we value the fact that we all need police. We need police there to help our society stay safe and to keep people safe, people of all races, creeds, religions, all socioeconomic factors, everybody needs police. And Katie Daviscourt was there as citizen journalist. She's a frequent friend of the Dory Monson show. She joins us now to give us a firsthand account of how that all turned out. Katie, thanks so much for making the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, David. Looking forward to talking to you.
Yeah. So, okay, usually when you're having a Back the Blue rally, you expect protesters to show up. You expect Antifa to show up and to do their usual thing. What made this rally different from others?
Let's just get started with exactly what happened at this rally. So organizers, Back Blue organizers, Savannah Kerr, she worked with Seattle Police Department and secured police presence from inside the event for over about 2 weeks. She was told that we would have Seattle PD come, what they normally do, inside the event and separate the two opposing groups. But they were ordered to stand down. And so they allowed Antifa to have free reign over the event, which put us into a very hostile and dangerous situation. I have been covering these for close to 2 years now, and I have never in my life seen Seattle PD stand down. And we are in extremely unprecedented times right now with Antifa and BLM becoming more emboldened, that the call and decision for them to stand down was very dangerous and very incompetent, I believe. But it's just amazing to me because Antifa, they are really a domestic terrorist group. And for SPD not to establish dominant authority and to back away really put us all in danger. I know I personally was harassed by Antifa. I'm a huge target to Antifa. I report unfavorably of them. And unfortunately, Antifa hates me probably just as much as they hate the Seattle police officers. So I was going into the event dressed as myself. I'm someone who relies on the police protection at these events. And I'm just going in as Katie Davis Court. You know, it would have been nice to be alerted, oh, guess what, you guys are, or Seattle PD, we're not going to show up, we're going to stand down. And the thing that is so upsetting to me is that the Seattle police officers were standing hundreds of feet away, just watching, and Antifa was allowed to have free reign. They verbally harassed us. They personally chased me around. They got into our faces. I was attacked. I was maced, completely unprovoked. My friend was maced. Beth Durantzing was maced. One of the security guards was spit on. Adam Bartholomew, who's running for office, he had urine thrown at him. They hijacked our event. They took over the stage. And what is really upsetting to me is that the event organizers ended up calling 911 multiple times to try to get police to come in and help, and they basically laughed into their faces. And they even walked over to the officers and said, why are you guys standing down? And they were ordered to stand down. So for the lieutenant to order Seattle police to stand down during these unprecedented times where, you know, we, Antifa, they are violent criminals. That's exactly what they are. And they really put us into a dangerous situation. For like the whole time, I was just waiting for Seattle Police to come, and they never showed up. And I honestly, I thought I was on the show Pumped. I was waiting for Ashton Kutcher to come out and be like, yeah, yeah, this is a joke, because we really, they have never stood down. I have never seen this happen. And I do have some sort of inside information. There were a lot of, there were multiple witnesses that told me that they saw Mayor Jenny very briefly at the event. So the only thing that is giving me peace of mind is knowing that possibly Mayor Jenny talked to the lieutenant and the commander and made them stand down, which dereliction of duty. Summer of Love, Mayor Jenny. This is not Summer of Love. This is really, really terrible times and put us all in danger. And I'm a law-abiding citizen. I pay my taxes. I live in Seattle, and I'm someone that actually wants police protection and safety, and our officers deserve better. The officers that I spoke with were horrified that they were told to stand down. They could not believe that they were told to stand down. I had a few reach out to me and apologize. They wish that they could have intervened, but it's the politics, and if anything, this just goes to say that we need to stand up for our police even stronger than ever before, because clearly politics is running the show. And if we don't start changing things around in our city, in our city council, then we're probably, you know, they're going to win. The peace is going to be abolished. And it's really, it's not just affecting the officers, but it's affecting the citizens of Seattle. I don't feel safe living here. And if I knew Seattle PD was backing down and wouldn't have protected us, I would have never showed up. And anyone else would have never showed up either, because we're targets walking into the lion den. And honestly, we're very lucky that all they did was mace us, and they also threw projectiles, but we're very lucky that people didn't get more hurt than they did.
Well, I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head here, which is that if you knew that this was going to happen, you wouldn't show up, because you mentioned that this is incompetence, but it's only incompetent if they thought, or if it was done because they didn't think police presence was needed. And that's not really believable. It's not rational at this point. It's very obvious. But if your political objective is to silence people, is to make sure that people don't speak out, and therefore you force the police to back away so that Antifa can run roughshod, assault people, you know, harass them, throw urine at them, take over the stage, it makes it so that those who might be willing to speak out in the midst of downtown Seattle will not do so, for fear of their own safety, for fear of their equipment, for fear of what might happen with Antifa. If that's the objective, and I tend to think it is, then it becomes very competent, but also very, very sinister and very awful. And it is a strike against, you know, the freedom of the people of the city, because it shouldn't matter what your politics are, you know, who you are. What should matter is everybody deserves the right to speak out. They have a First Amendment right. They should be secure in their own possessions and secure in their personal safety. That seems to me to be a very, very basic job of the city and of law enforcement. I would like to know, are you going to follow up and try to figure out who gave the order ultimately to stand down and publish that?
I know I have the names of the lieutenant who told the officers to stand down, but I need to confirm that Mayor – I have not confirmed that Mayor Jenny spoke with them, but just from speculation and from people on the ground, they witnessed her at the event, multiple did. So that, I've never seen that in my life either. But, yeah, like what you said was Antifa uses intimidation tactics to silence opposition, and they use violence, and this was a family event. Luckily there were no kids there, but it was promoted as a family event, and no one should be subjected to that.
Well, and that's why there's no kids there, is because people are scared of these characters now, and that this is kind of a spreading. There's on multiple fronts, there are efforts to silence people via intimidation all over the place, in the public, in the workspace, everywhere, where people are trying to make sure that people don't feel free to speak out, because to do so may invoke all kinds of consequences. And there's kind of a you know, there's a self-justified hysteria going on, which I find dangerous. We have audio of Antifa targeting you with a chant specifically. We had to bleep it a little bit because it's not fit for air. But, Nicole, you want to play that cut? Sounds like a heart monitor, doesn't it? It's they're yelling, you know, F Katie Davis Court. That's over and over and over again. So they're specifically chanting your name, you by name, because of your journalistic activities. Question, has any other journalist outlets spoken out to you about this, or spoken on your behalf about this kind of danger?
Blaze TV has, but other than that, no one else, no local has. And it's very, like what you said, I'm a huge target for Antifa, so going to this event as myself, dressed as myself, put me into a very dangerous situation. And when I do go and report on Antifa, I do go undercover. So if I knew I was walking into the lion's den, I would not have showed up. And I would have left, but every time I tried to leave, they chased me. And what they do is they chase people to their cars. And I honestly had no idea how I was going to leave the event, but they did end up having a mob come after me and push me out of the event. And then luckily I was able to go to some bike officers to help me after they maced me and filed a police report. But I'm not the only one that they chased out of the event. They also followed a security person who was supplying security for the event. They followed him home. They followed him to his house. And they attack when you're at your weakest. So they go after people who leave the event. They go after, like, Beth Durantin. She is a middle-aged woman, just a nice woman running for office as well. And they maced her. So it's unbelievable. And I love SPD. This has not changed my support for them. I'm not at all upset with the officers. I am upset with the order to stand down because really put us in danger, especially, I mean, I'm not going to say especially myself, but yes, especially myself, because they really, really hate me. And
well, you're a target. I mean, you're a named target because you're outspoken. And as a symbol, if they can bring you down, they bring other people down because people are going to look at you and say, hey, look, you know, I don't want to end up like her. And same with the woman you're describing leaving. I don't want to end up being maced, which is, you know, assaulted with chemicals on the way out, because who knows what the next step is. Katie Davis Court, thanks so much for making the time here on the Dory Monson Show.
Thank you. Thanks. Dory, so stand with Dory.
Thanks, Katie. Appreciate it. Yeah, a lot of love for Dory out there and here. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Schools are not super spreaders. You know, the big fear fest going on, keeping kids out of school, not necessary. It looks like it should be safer for kids to go back to schools. And yet, you know, there's a big holdoff. There's a lot of fear involved, fear in part because of media coverage and fear in part from politicians. Now, it's not me saying that. And it's not a right-wing, you know, news source. It's not the Trump administration, it's the Atlantic, hardly known to be a right-wing or a Trump-supporting source. But the headline is Schools Aren't Super Spreaders. It's a story from economist at Brown University, Emily Oster. And she's pointing out that the latest studies show that the infection rate among schools that are open, among the 200,000 kids in 47 states that they collected data on over the last couple of weeks in September revealed an infection rate of 0.13% among students and 0.24% among staff. About 1.3 infections over 2 weeks in a school of 1,000 kids, or 2.2 infections over 2 weeks in a group of 1,000 staff. Even in high-risk areas of the country, the student rates were well under one-half of 1%. And so Texas reported 1,490 cases among students for the week ending on September 27th, with 1,080,317 students estimated at school. That's a rate of 0.14%. Staff rate was lower, 0.1%. What's interesting about that is, remember, so many people, rather smugly and unfortunately in my view, were pointing and saying, look, these red states, that's where all the death is going to occur. Red states are going to be infecting everybody. And, you know, so they should be taking a look at this and saying, okay, well, what's going on in Texas and why aren't they having the spread that we thought they were going to? In other words, it might require rethinking your initial position, even if it means agreeing with your political opponents. It's kind of like masks, you know. You might think wearing a mask is a horrible idea, and then all of a sudden you see things like, I don't know, that anecdotal story about the Starbucks where one person walks in, has a major case of the virus, people that didn't have masks on all got infected, people who had the masks on the whole time, namely the staff, did not. You know, so there's anecdotal evidence like that, which was leading to people wearing masks to reduce the incidence of infection. So you take a look at this thing, this story, and it goes on and points out that governors, and I can think of one locally here, who claim that they're all, you know, on the side of science and comparing themselves with these supposedly anti-science administration, seem to be unaware of the new evidence. They use New York Governor Cuomo as the example, still calling schools mass spreaders, even though that is not the case. David Bowe is in for Dory Monson on 97.3 Cairo FM.